Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
The following is a special presentation from Comey Media Incorporated.
The storytellers get to have their say. I'm Cole Johnson, and thank you so very much for joining me, or I should say us. Welcome back to another edition of Return to View, but this time, as you can see, we're doing it a little different. This special presentation is called The Roundtable. This is Volume 1 of The Roundtable. It's an informal panel-like setting between journalists and me where we discuss the cases they're covered. Now, I can't do this panel alone. I need to have some esteemed guests. And here they are. From the Janet and Marissa Shugley case, reporter for the Daily American in Somerset, Pennsylvania, Eric Keita. Along with Eric, the managing editor of the Daily American, Bruce Seawey.
Good afternoon.
From the Lisa Todd case, reporter for the Bucks County Courier Times in Levittown, Pennsylvania, Joe Chevalier. From the Patty Patton case, reporter for the Beaver County Times in Beaver, Pennsylvania, Danny Fitzgerald. From the Lee Van Luvender case, reporter for the Pocono Record in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, Hannah Phillips.
Good to be here.
And from the Courtney Stauffer case, reporter for the Lebanon Daily News in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, Matthew Toth.
Hello.
Eric, Bruce, Joe, Danny, Hannah, Matthew, welcome to the Roundtable Volume 1. And I'll begin with this question, and this is for the whole panel. Now, I know that things in your case that you've covered have impressed a lot upon you. In the cases that you did not cover, and that we've recorded on Return to View, which thing stood out to you? And it could be anybody.
I thought the Courtney Stauffer case was pretty interesting just because of how recent it was and everything involving that situation with the yearly presentations that they do on the river down there and with the family and friends and their participation. But that was one that really stood out to me that I was interested in.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, the Lee Van Luvender case was fascinating. I feel so badly for that family, and I can't imagine having closure, in that situation. So, yeah, that was a rough one.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was a rough one for me, actually.
I thought the Patty Patton case was pretty powerful, given that, it happened so long ago, and it seems like if it happened today, given all the technology and advances in crime investigation, it seems like that one probably would have been solved. It's kind of amazing it hasn't been solved.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
I feel like the Marissa case kind of stands out a little bit for me. Knowing some of those people a little bit and actually some of the quotes about the turnpike itself, something that we kind of just take for granted going down back and forth and knowing that it actually could be more, and knowing this case happened on a place that, everybody just kind of doesn't even think about taking their next direction, kind of stood out in my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel similar to Joe about the Patty Patton case. To go so long without answers, I can't imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't either. Bruce?
Yeah, and I really just think that Joe hit on something that's really interesting in the sense that you wonder if there are cases here that because of when they occurred, that they would have been solved. And that's, you know, goes for almost all of them, because many of them are, you know, several years or decades old, and the technology has changed. And I think the investigative methods have changed. And so I think that's part of the, I think they're all interesting in their own right, but that's sort of the chilling and bothersome part of it is, you know, nowadays I think there would be a much greater chance of having closure for a lot of these families if the crimes had occurred in contemporary times versus decades ago. And, you know, I think part of our job is doing whatever we can to at least keep the conversation alive and just make sure that people are thinking about it and talking about it. And there could possibly be some lead down the road that would lead to closure for these families.
Yes, especially, Bruce, considering that, you know, maybe in the early 90s, certainly in the 2000s, a lot of forensic evidence was taken from cases, DNA, blood samples, things like that, which, I mean, I know they do downgrade after a certain amount of time, depending on how they're preserved, but it's entirely possible that the answers could be out there.
I mean, I think one of the things we all kind of touched on in every story I read and stuff I wrote was the need to keep an alertness, to keep an eye on some of these cases, and the fact that these things can easily fall into obscurity, whether it's something just a couple of years ago or something that happened decades ago, and bringing those things back to light to know that they are still at the edge of your mind can always bring a new perspective to these cases and maybe hopefully some outcomes.
Yeah. To that point, it seemingly, when we actually recorded some of these episodes, the amazing thing that I've heard from all of you is the immediate response of some movement in whatever the case may have been, because they just heard the episode and they'd say, oh, or they read the story that y'all did and they say, you know, this new development came and I think I have to revisit this. And it would be like within a week's time. And then, you know, I would think it'd be overtime, but I would not think it'd be that immediate. So I think it just goes to show the work that y'all put in and the work that, that this, basically this body of work is supposed to represent. And it just shows how important it is to what we do. And I appreciate all of you in doing this. Now, we started this storytelling journey into true crime on July 28th. And that would be the time when the Janet and Marissa Shugley in a case that involved two women, or a woman and a girl, I said, who disappeared in summer 85. That is the story that we're going to touch on now. Now, the case was covered by Bruce Seawee and Eric Keita. Eric, Bruce, either one. What drew you to research this case, and what moment stood out to you in terms of the investigation?
In terms of what drew us into it, for me, it was following up on a development that occurred a few years ago. We had published a story in the newspaper about the class ring of Janet's that had been found. And police were very vague about that. They didn't release a lot of details or information, but they found her class ring, which was, you know, after decades of her being missing. And so there was the question of, would this lead to closure? Would this lead to, you know, at least maybe finding Janet Marissa? So we started with that premise of just following up on that. And that drew us into, you know, some different territory, maybe some uncharted territory, and also allowed us to answer for people what the situation was with the ring. It turned out it was inconsequential. They believed that Janet had lost it prior to going missing, not far from her high school. And so it didn't end up going anywhere. But I think, first of all, it was answering for readers the question of whether or not the ring was a consequential piece of evidence, and then looking ahead and moving forward and you know, sort of just opening things up again, at least in the public forum, so that people are talking about it and so that the case itself just didn't fade into obscurity.
Hmm.
It's just a sad story altogether. I mean, it's a shame when anybody goes missing, but whenever you're a 10-year-old girl and you go missing with your mother, I mean, you're pretty much completely innocent at that age. But one of the people I reached out to was the son of Janet, Josh Ugly, and he was just a small child at the time, but he was more than willing to cooperate. He was on board with the project, and it was just an interesting aspect to talk to him. You know, he himself just wants to see closure after all this time.
Yeah. I can imagine. Because he was, what, all of 5 when this took place? So, yeah, I could totally understand. Now, there were some developments that came after the story was written and the episode aired. What were those developments, and are we any closer to a resolution?
There's still some open-ended things going on. State police did discuss searching Somerset Lake, which is near the motel where they were last seen. The lake had been drawn down for some dam repairs, and so for the first time they would have access to basically walk through it versus, you know, doing some sort of underwater submersion. And so state police did confirm that they were doing that. We believe that that has transpired. We are waiting to hear confirmation on the results of that. So that was a big thing as part of this as well, that, you know, police were moving forward with searching in a different manner than they had in the past. And, you know, just trying to check one more box, you know, try to rule out at least maybe where they aren't. And the other side of it too, and I took a call actually just right before we began here, is that the sister of Janet, has apparently retained a private investigator, and he has talked vaguely about some updates and some questions and, maybe some other developments that really haven't been out there in the past. And so, you know, we're planning to work with him and with Janet's sister to try to, you know, draw more light to this and find out, you know, what exactly is happening now behind the scenes. Because as Eric mentioned, Janet's son, Josh, hasn't given up. Her sister, has not given up. And so there's still movement behind the scenes right now. And we're going to follow that. And, you know, hopefully it does lead to resolution.
And I was told after we started reporting on this, from multiple sources that we use in the episode, that after state police heard that we were looking into this, that they did reach out to them to reinvestigate.
Hmm. Wow. This is amazing, the moving parts that I heard as soon as the episode aired. And it seemed as if it was as if just movement that I didn't think it was going to happened then. Bruce, now you played the voice of Frank Shugley when he was defending himself about 30 years ago. What went into your mind when you actually did the dramatization?
It was just a wild exchange. I mean, you're reading it through a court transcript, and so, you know, you're trying to inflect and maybe interpret the way things were happening at that time. And just the entire scenario was sort of bizarre. I mean, you're talking about Frank Shugley and the judge that he was seen before in 1991. Right. This was a strange component to the case where Frank had been convicted in a murder-for-hire plot, you know, against his wife or against his wife's relatives. And so just sort of, you know, trying to claw back into that and see what exactly was happening at that time, because it just becomes such a convoluted scenario where Frank's wife and daughter go missing. Then he's convicted in murder for hire because he believes that they're alive, but hiding from him. Just a really strange scenario. And just wanted to take the time here as well to just mention that Eric and I had reached out to Frank. We'd hoped to interview him during the original reporting, and it's a standing invitation to him as well. If at any point he would want to follow up with us and have a discussion, you know, that would be greatly appreciated. We hope for his participation originally, and that we would love to hear his thoughts on the case and what may have happened to his wife and daughter.
Yeah. Yeah. Just imagine being the husband of a daughter and a wife disappearing. Yeah. It would just bother me. So there was just many question marks I had about, and I still do to this day have, about that case. And y'all did a wonderful job on it. That was the case that I knew that we were onto something in terms of, okay, I think this might be a vehicle we can properly tell stories. Now, the case where I felt assured of the whole show's direction, that would be the Lisa Tai case. And that debuted on August the 25th. Now, the case was covered by Joe Chevalier. Now, Joe, what does this case mean to you personally? And what type of impact did a disappearing teenager have on the whole area?
Well, actually, in 1985, when Lisa Todd disappeared, I was a teenager myself. Actually, I learned when this case came back into the public attention last March, when police, after nearly 30, 40 years, had actually identified Lisa Todd as the unknown female, formerly known as Jane Doe Publicker, or Publicker Jane Doe. She and I have the same birthday, 1 year apart, so it's pretty freaky to me. So, you know, this case started out as an unidentified woman, unidentified person case in Bensalem Township, which is a suburb of Philadelphia here in southeastern Pennsylvania. Bensalem has about 8 unsolved or unidentified body cases. This is one of them and one of their oldest. Actually, I think it was their oldest case. And we've written about it here at our newspaper periodically through the years. You know, there were many times they thought Publicker Jane was someone else. And it turned out she wasn't that person. And what fascinated me is that Lisa Todd was just not on anyone's radar. Nobody aside from her family even knew she was missing. And a lot, and they thought she ran away. They didn't realize something bad had happened to her. So just very chilling in every respect. And sad.
It was chilling all the way around. When I first got a hold of that story, I just said, wow. It sent chills down my spine just in reading it and then hearing the accounts of it. It still shakes me. Now this was the case also where new technologies seemed to be introduced when it came to forensics. One of those advances was forensic sculpture. So how has that particular advancement influenced other cases besides the Publicker Jane Doe case?
Well, what I think is really interesting about the Lisa Todd Publicker Jane Doe case is you really see a flow of how criminal investigation has changed with the advancement of DNA technology and other tools. In 1994, which was about 4 or 5 years after they had found the remains of Publicker Jane Doe at the bottom of a well on a former whiskey distillery property, they had a bust made of her face using her skull. And it was done by a renowned forensics sculptor. And they redid it. They had a press conference. They took it to local schools. And no one still recognized who this person was. So it wasn't again until around 2002 when Detective Chris McMullen kind of had the case fall in his lap. And that was at a time when police were just beginning to use things like the World Wide Web to put out information and to gather information on cases, missing people, really opened things up for getting information. And so he put the Publicker Jane Doe information out on several websites, NamUs, other missing unsolved crime websites. And then, you know, from there, 2007, he got a grant to have DNA actually extracted from the remains of Publicker Jane Doe. And so they were able to get, you know, DNA evidence. That evidence eventually was used as, again, DNA technology advanced, was able to be used to create to put her into GEDmatch, which is used to find genealogical matches for family, like all over the world. And that was how they were finally able last year, or I should say earlier this year, to match Publicker Jane Doe as Lisa Todd.
Right. Right. Now, the overall story was about a teenager being missing since 1985, but not identified properly until 2021. Now, that may be the case. However, the story also showed the determination of a local detective. Talk to me about one Chris McMullen and how huge of a role he has played and seemingly he does play even now in your research.
Chris McMullen is dedicated to cold cases, and he has a certain number of cold cases. He's, you know, getting ready to retire in about 18 months. And he has certain cold cases that he has been looking at since, you know, the early 2000s that he wants to see solved. One of them was the publisher Jane Doe case. So now that he knows who she is, he really wants to find out what happened to her and how she ended up in that well. And he, if it was not for Chris McMullen, I don't think that this case ever would have been solved, because it takes a lot of time and a lot of energy and to run down these leads, to, you know, beg and plead with your superiors to get genetic testing, which is expensive, to beg and plead with genealogical groups to get them to maybe give you the testing for free. So, you know, without that kind of follow-up and determination, these cases would not get solved. And I don't think it's just Chris McMullen. It's any law enforcement officer who's involved in these type of cases.
Right. Yeah, and I totally agree with that assessment. I really do. Now, the first two cases dealt with disappearances. But this next case, Patty Patton, debuted on September 29th and was covered by Danny Fitzgerald. Now, what made this case unique is it involved the death of a four-year-old girl. The perplexing part is that her death hasn't been solved since 1956. So what else besides that staggering understanding stood on this case to you, Danny?
Yeah, so, you know, according to Patty's siblings who are still alive, who I was able to speak with, you know, they really said that this, the whole case was highly politicized. And, you know, it was during an election year, so there's obviously controversy around that. And there was a lot of controversy around whether or not it was a homicide. So it was at first deemed a homicide, and then it, you know, the coroner, you know, felt a lot of pressure from the district attorney to not declare it a homicide. So, you know, that just kind of sets the tone of different things happening, things that were confusing, you know, along the way there was evidence that was lost. So, you know, it kind of makes you feel for the family all the more, because it just seems like at the very beginning, there's so much controversy around something that seems like, you know, a four-year-old girl lost her life. Let's find out who did it. And there was all these little things that kept coming up that seemed like roadblocks in the way.
Yeah, yeah. That was the biggest red flag for me. I'm saying to myself, this four-year-old girl's dead. You mean tell me it still has not been solved? It seems backwards. I would think that I would think law enforcement would bend themselves over backwards to find this, just to find justice for her and the family. But going through this case, that seemingly was not what happened. And of course, understandably so, the family seemed to be angry and perplexed and all out of sorts, even to this moment. And it also seemed like investigators were pretty much done with trying to find someone culpable for murder. So how can the family, Jim and Pamela in particular, get any type of resolution?
Yeah, you know, it's tough because it's happened so long ago, and a lot of the players, or even, you know, the two main suspects aren't alive anymore. And so it's really tough because it doesn't appear that investigators are going to go any further with the case. So again, you just feel for the family and you feel for the siblings, and you know, I don't necessarily think that closure is going to be possible in this case if they're not going to go any further with it, which is tragic. You know, it's a tragic situation. You know, the only thing I can think of is that perhaps just knowing that after all these years, they still haven't given up on Patty. And, you know, Pamela was Patty's younger sister. She wasn't even alive when this happened. Right. And still she's dedicated truly her life to finding justice for Patty after all of these years. And she has had children and grandchildren and you know, warn them of, you know, being safe and always being with someone, not going anywhere alone. And she's been traumatized, you know, through this whole situation. And so I think just having the sense that they haven't given up on Patty after all these years, it might give them some sense of solace.
Yeah. Anything that would give them some sort of relief. Mm-hmm. And give them some answers, because I can understand just this open-ended question mark just seems to not fit. And so in reading your story before I even began to record the episode, I just felt this pall when it came to Patty's mother, Bernice. So you had the opportunity to channel Bernice Patton in yelling for Patty when she discovered her daughter was not in the yard when she left the house and just was playing in the yard. What went through your mind when you did the voiceover, and what did your neighbors think when you recorded it?
Yeah. You know, honestly, I thought it was going to be easy to just shout out Patty's name, but you know, on a serious note, it was odd to do that, because, you know, I feel like there aren't many times you get to just scream somebody's name. But to do that, I felt like I had a really, really small glimpse of the urgency that her mom and her family must have felt to see that your baby is missing. And so that was oddly, you know, it was an odd, sad experience, even though I was just pretending. So that was a unique experience. But you know, kind of comically, I live in a duplex, and so my neighbors live above me, and I was going to shout and start, you know, saying Patty's name before I let them know, but I thought, you know what, I better send them a text real quick. And so I did, and they said that they were so happy that I did, because they could hear me very, very clearly, and they would have been very worried, you know, if I hadn't told them. So yeah, it was a, you know, even a small, you know, I think this whole experience, with this podcast just shows even a small experience of doing a voiceover really just gives you a little glimpse of the pain for sure.
As I can tell you, to me, the episode just made a whole lot of sense when I got back your voiceover and I said, this feels exactly like the emotion I wanted to have the whole audio to capture. Because I feel like the whole family has had this desperation the whole while long.
Yeah.
And to me, that voiceover just set the tone for everything else. Eric, excuse me. You also had a voiceover role in this episode, reading the letter of the, reading the letter of the Beaver County Chief of Detectives, Andrew Gall. How was the process for you, and what did you feel about the material before you delivered the voiceover?
I mean, the process was just like any other. I'm like myself, like I would anybody else that I was interviewing. But I mean, as far as the statement goes, it was a pretty straightforward statement. I mean, I didn't know a lot about the case yet. I haven't seen the episode yet, and Danny obviously did the reporting on that one. So I really didn't have too strong a feeling on it. One thing I thought was kind of interesting, though, is that they release a statement rather than, you know, doing an interview in person. I don't know if that had any bearing on the case or not, but that's pretty much my take.
Yeah, and I think the tone you took was perfect, because I think from what I understood in reading the case over, it seemed as though the family had the urgency, like Danny was saying, with Bernice screaming out her daughter's name. But just opposed to that, it seemed as though the law enforcement throughout the whole time period has been more matter-of-factly, and it seemed as though it wasn't urgent for them. So it seemed like it was this push-pull with that. The family feeling as though this is an urgent matter, and law enforcement for this in this particular case basically giving the energy that it wasn't. Mm. And I found that to be interesting. And then when I heard your voiceover, I was like, this is perfect.
No, thank you. Yeah, just try to be straightforward with it, so.
Yeah. Nailed it. The next case that we did dealt with a gruesome murder. We covered the Lee Van Luvender murder in the Poconos, and that premiered on October 27th. Hannah Phillips covered that story, which involved a then 22-year-old hunting enthusiast. Now, how does the community look at the murder which took place as of this recording 14 years ago?
Right. So it's interesting when you talk about community, because the Poconos is such a huge vacation destination that I know that within law enforcement, there's a fear that the people who were here at the time of Lee's murder aren't here anymore. So like his mother and the police here do everything they can to keep it in the public eye. But like December 4th is going to be the 14th anniversary of his death. And I know there is a fear that it's just not as a priority, not as in the forefront of the community's mind as it was 14 years ago. Yeah, like the billboards are still up. The reward for any information about his murder is still available. But I don't think the community has held on to it as tightly as like his mother and the law enforcement here have.
Yeah. I would tend to agree with that assessment. I really would. And which makes my heart break all the more for Charlene Sebring, the mother of Lee Van Luvender. And the story centered around her, her grief, and a retired officer. The two dealt with a loss of different natures at the time, and it seemed to bond the two of them even more than usual. So how has the Charlene Sebring and Richard Luthke friendship helped and possibly hurt the ongoing investigation involving Lee Van Luvender?
Right. So Detective Richard Luthke, he's been on this case since day one. And he was really proactive immediately about bringing Charlene in and letting her know, like, he's going to do everything to solve her son's murder. A couple years after Lee was killed, he lost his own son, who was young. And he actually tried retiring from law enforcement soon after that death. It impacted him in a very negative way. But as far as how it impacted the case, I could only guess that it strengthened his resolve to answer it, to solve it. I mean, he can relate to the grief that Charlene feels. He lost his son a different way than, like, he knows how his son died, whereas Charlene has no clue still if the person who killed her son is, like, walking beside her in the grocery store. So they don't share the same grief, but I know that he relates to her, and I know that it has driven him. And I also think it haunts him a little bit to have to retire this year. This is the only major case of his that hasn't been solved. He tells me he thinks about it every day. And I know he's not thinking about Lee as much as he's thinking about his mom and how much hurt she still carries every single day. So when you ask, like, how it may have hurt the case, I don't think it did, but I do think it's had his closeness with her has taken a toll, like, on his own personal life.
You know, in dealing with Detective Luthke, seeing how Charlene has dealt with all of this, it seems like it's a great study in empathy. It seems like he has done the best I think any person ever could to step outside of one's shoes and put themselves in another and fully try to understand and wrap their brain and their hearts and their souls around how a person could feel what they feel. And he seems as though he really relates to the pain in terms of, wow, I could imagine this is a painful thing. And he moves accordingly. Even to this day, he moves accordingly. And I find that to be the most impressive aspect of it all.
Yeah. Like, Charlene will tell you that she doesn't trust people. She has trust issues now, especially after her son was killed.
Yeah.
But he trusts Detective Luthke.
Yeah.
He's the reason I was able to interview Charlene. We did it at Detective Luthke's house because they trust each other.
Yeah.
And I think his empathy has a lot to do with that.
And most certainly does. Now, you mentioned earlier that there's an award for anyone who can step forward and find the person possibly responsible for Lee Van Leeuwen's murder. I think you sort of alluded to it. How well has the gesture been received? And has the Pocono Mountain Regional Police received any type of tip regarding this case whatsoever?
So the tips have slowed down. They come less frequently the more years that pass. I know Charlene told me that she's been like exploited. People have come to her and said, I have information, but give me half of the tip and then I'll tell you. People have tried to take advantage of her. People have given her false information. She takes it all and brings it to Detective Lefke, who checks it all out. And every tip she's gotten has not led to anything. Yeah, as far as the tips go, they just come less frequently. But because Detective Lefke is retiring, the investigation is changing hands over to the new detective, Craig Van Leeuwen. So I'm hopeful that he's going to try and stir up some answers.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of interesting aspects of that case. And, and hopefully that there's answers to be found. And hopefully Charlene can find the happiness that she so desperately seeks. I don't know how, because I know how attached she was to her son. But if the justice that she seeks helps any, I hope she finds it.
Yeah, me too.
Now, that wasn't the only case that we have covered which involved an award for a person of interest. The other case that has an award for a person of interest is the Courtney Stauffer case. Now, this one premiered on November 17th and was reported by Matthew Toth. Now, there seems to be an attitude with investigators that they are at an impasse. How has the case progressed since the episode premiered?
Well, whenever this case is brought to the public eye, of course, tips tend to grow. But over the last couple of years, those tips wane generally fast after those initial reports come out. The family has put out a $10,000 or $100,000 reward, for any solid information that leads to Courtney Stauffer's whereabouts. Just speaking with the family, they had said that new detectives have been put on the case to put fresh eyes onto the case itself, as well as older detectives trying to still be active and a part of it. But information is what people need, and unfortunately it's information that they lack. The case has led to the draining of several lakes out here in the early couple of years. There were searches, and still, unfortunately, not enough leads to have either an idea about where Courtney's whereabouts are, or even to suggest a person of interest or a suspect in her case. At this point in time, the family always asks if people have information to reach out to Lebanon County detectives or the FBI, Crime Stoppers. I know her father has even suggested that people could reach out directly to him if they want to do so personally. But what they're looking for more than anything is closure at this point. Some answers leading to what might have happened to Courtney almost a decade ago.
Now, you were speaking about the family, Courtney's mother, Wendy, Courtney's father, Scott, and Courtney's sister, Kirsten, have all stated how much Courtney has meant to all of them. How is it possible that they can keep any type of optimism amid not being any closer to coming to a resolution?
Well, I think, honestly, they create their own optimism for a resolution. Just speaking with the family, it would be easy to just possibly at this point give up a little bit, say maybe we'll never have answers. And instead of doing that, they want to push Courtney's story and her life, frankly, first and foremost to the residents every year on her anniversary, but especially even more than that. The family has reached out to local clothing designers recently to get tie-dye t-shirts with Remember Me Courtney out there that they released about the exact same time that we released our story to the public. They are planning events to make sure that people remember Courtney as well out here. And whenever you go to one of these events, it doesn't feel like some kind of wake or some kind of mourning. It feels like a celebration for someone they describe as being incredibly loud, incredibly loving of life. You know, her sister remarks about how she can still hear her laughter even now on how it resonates with her. And just that, you know, kind of keeps her memory alive. And they want to keep her memory alive to hopefully get some answers.
Yeah. And hopefully they will. Now, you were talking about that optimism. I think, and things that they do to keep her memory alive, one of them seems to be an event they hold, and I think you mentioned it earlier, that commemorates Courtney's life and involves water tubing from Palmyra, Pennsylvania to Harrisburg. How does the investigation get impacted after they hold the Flow for Courtney Stauffer event at the end of every July?
I think the best way to describe it is, I mean, you go out to this event and you're expecting, you know, maybe something solemn or quiet, maybe some like tearful discussions about Courtney. And what you get is something close to a fair or kind of a grandstand. You get people who actually get on these tubes and blare out the country music and talk about Courtney, not as just a tragic figure, but as someone who you know, lived life a lot and actually lived it to the fullest. And through those discussions, through even these pictures of people who do care and love for this person who they have no answers for, you get that sense of a growth in the community. I know that just when we had them sit down and talk a little bit, they brought one of her friends who they said has become family for them. Right. And in those kind of discussions, like I said, they get an increase of people providing tips. But what they need now is, you know, something that will actually lead to an answer.
Mm. And hopefully they do get that answer. Wow. Yeah, it's amazing how this life that is so vivacious got snuffed out real quick. And all of a sudden, you know, it's amazing this vivacious thing got silenced in a quick moment. Yeah, it's amazing. Well, we looked at the cases we've done, but let's look at one of the cases that we're going to do right now.
Alicia Markovich was only 15 years old when she was last seen in Blairsville.
It's been uneasy for the last 34 years, not knowing where she's at and whether she's even still possibly alive. It's been difficult. We just decided, you know what, Marcy, she really never had anybody to stand beside her to help her do all this.
Her friends and family seek answers into her disappearance.
The Alicia Markovich Argumentative Dilemma Case is next on Return to View. Premiering January 26th for subscribers only. Join now for just $1 to receive premium content like Return to View. That's $1 to become a subscriber and a Return to View loyal listener.
Tune into the next episode, Alicia Markovich, Argument of the Dilemma, January 26th, from the Daily American and select e-edition platforms in the USA Today network. Well, let's stay with that case, actually. Bruce, Eric, tell me why the Alicia Markovich case is an important one to cover.
Well, it's just chilling. I mean, you're talking about a 15-year-old girl who just vanishes from the face of the earth, and the family has no answers. She was from Wimber, which was in Somerset County. She was apparently last with her father before she vanished and left the house after an argument. And for her family and friends to go through, you know, several decades now and not have an idea of where she went, who she's with, if she's alive. It's just another one of those really, really difficult to swallow situations where you really just feel for them because, you know, that's their, you know, Marcy, her mother, that's her baby still, you know, and to this day, she's really just, distraught over this, understandably. And it's just important because in this case, you know, they're keeping it alive in their own way. And that it's another one where the family has pushed and the friends are pushing in new ways because of the internet to try to find closure. And we just want to do our part to get the word out there as well.
Yeah. Like Bruce said, the family basically is to the point where they just want this solved. I mean, this is 1987, whenever she went missing from Blairsville. I mean, since recently they've taken out a billboard, you know, asking for tips on the case. They've been putting up flyers out in Blairsville in that area. And Marcy, the mother, as Bruce mentioned, she was just a young woman herself when she had Alicia. And she basically, the one on everyone we were talking, basically said that, you know, that's her baby. And she basically grew up with her. But yeah, they just really want answers on the case. And yeah, I mean, me and Bruce are actively working on it. In fact, I have a call to make on it as soon as we hang up from this meeting. So.
And tomorrow, Eric and I are meeting with state police for that interview to you know, see what they're able to talk about in relation to it. There are some strange aspects to it. There was apparently a letter that was sent to her father several years ago that, you know, in which an anonymous person seemed to claim to be the killer and tell the police where the body was. And when police searched, there was no trace of the body. And when they went to the return address from the letter, was it New Hampshire, Vermont, Eric?
New Hampshire, I believe. And I believe that's where weren't they claiming that that's where her body was up there too?
I thought the letter was from there, but it was saying that she was, she wasn't far from Blairsville where she was found. And so, yeah, they searched that lead and that, you know, police, I believe after looking into it, believe that the letter now was a hoax. So, it didn't bring them any closer, at least on the surface, to finding her or finding out what happened there. But it's such a strange twist to the entire case. It, you know, somebody would go through the effort to lead police on a wild goose chase and send a letter. Just some really, really bizarre twists in this one. And as we mentioned about the sort of the progress and momentum with the family and others, I mean, it's really outside of the area even. There are people that aren't related to the Markovich family that never knew Alicia and still you know, they're sort of like web sleuths. They're all over it. You know, they're posting about it. They're creating pages for her. And the case just really disturbed a lot of people. And so, understandably, we're just trying to do our part, as I said, to get the word out there and see if there is someone out there that has information and can help the family get some answers.
Mm. Yeah. And what strikes me about her, she doesn't have the profile normally that you hear about girls who end up missing. I mean, straight A student and involved in athletics, and it just seemed to go left in a strange way. And I look forward to just digging more into that case for sure. Alicia Markovich will not be the only case that's on tap in the near future. We have another one out in Bucks County as well. Joe, you did an awesome job with Lisa Todd. Tell us about the Clubhouse Doe, girl behind the diner case.
So, as I had mentioned previously, Ben Salem has seven or eight unsolved or unidentified body cases. And the Clubhouse Doe case is a very interesting one. She was found by a couple of kids who were playing, trying to make a fort in the woods behind a popular diner called the Clubhouse Diner here in Bensalem. They were trying to make a fort in wooded area behind the diner. They found what they thought was a turtle shell. And it turned out to be the skull of a woman who police believe was placed there. This was in September of 1995. They believe that she was placed there 3 or 4 years earlier. Interesting things about this particular unidentified woman is she was found wrapped in a tarp, naked. Her clothing was found nearby, similar to Lisa Todd. She had a number of different pieces of clothing with her. In addition, she had a very unique crucifix, which after police did some investigating, they learned was only sold at the Vatican gift shop in Rome. Well, actually in the Vatican. So that's all they were able to find out about this particular case. And in looking in our archives, we really hadn't written much about this case since 1995. But this is another case where Detective Chris McMullen feels that he can find out who this woman is. The body, the remains were actually buried in a mausoleum in Bucks County privately. They were taken there. So he has been able to, this is years ago, he was able to get a court order to get DNA evidence. So he believes that, again, with the technology today, with things like GED matching and DNA and 23andMe, he believes that he can find out who this woman is. Unlike the Lisa Todd case, which was her autopsy found her death was undetermined, this one has been ruled a homicide. The woman was found strangled and bludgeoned. So they do believe that this is a murder, and Chris McMullen thinks he can solve it.
Well, with his determination, I do not have an issue with that. I mean, he probably will solve it, probably before we know it.
Well, you know, in these unsolved cases, you know, the key is, you know, finding out first who they are. Because once you find out a name, you know, that sometimes can move things along as far as finding out what happened.
Right. Definitely. Definitely. I look forward to that one as well. And another one we'll be highlighting in the future resides in Beaver County. Danny, your reporting on Patty Patton was riveting. You and our new Return to View reporting colleague, Garrett Roberts, will be covering this one. So tell us more about that one.
Yeah, so, you know, there are plenty of cases that we could cover. And I think the one we're going to go with is the Hiding Morningstar case. There's right now a reward actually being offered. So we have reason to believe that investigators have kind of are taking another look at it. And so this case is interesting. Heidi was 12 years old in 1976 when she went missing. She was watching her sibling at the time, and her family was briefly gone out of the house. When they came home, they found that there was a shopping cart outside of their home, a window screen on the house had been removed, and there was a muddy footprint on the floor. Heidi was found later in neighboring Allegheny County, right on the border between Allegheny County and Beaver County. She'd been strangled. But there's a few things that are interesting about this case. There's a woman who says she was a witness, and police allegedly used hypnosis on her to help refresh her memories about what happened. But then her testimony was called into question because of the use of hypnosis, because it's controversial. So it's super interesting. It's fascinating. And I think it's definitely worth looking into again, especially if investigators are wanting to crack it open again.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I totally agree with that. We look forward to all of those cases. I really am getting pumped about just all the details that I've just heard. But I think it's time for us to go. But I will wrap it up with one more question, and this is for the entire roundtable. In one sentence, what is your ultimate hope with the cases that we cover for Return to View? And anyone can start.
Justice.
and resolution. I mean, in some cases, you know, we don't know what happened to the individual. You know, in some cases, there may be just a question of an accident or something like that. I mean, when there's a clear crime committed, absolutely justice. And in other cases, you know, because we don't want to make assumptions about a disappearance, we would just say resolution for the family so they know what happened to their loved one.
I mean, I would echo Bruce there. One thing that sticks with the Courtney Stauffer case for me is when Kirsten Stauffer said to me, the family just wants closure. I think that resonates for a lot of these cases here, is the need for closure and the need to know, you know, what happened. For some of these that might never come about, but for some of these, just putting it out there, you know, ignites that fire and at least gives some hope that maybe a lead or some person out there can point the way in these instances.
Yeah, and I think for some cases too, where there might not be further investigating or anything like that. A lot of times, you know, like in the Patty Patton case, it's so old and it's clearly investigators have kind of given up. Nobody really talks about it or cares. But for the families, it's a big deal, obviously. And so sometimes even just talking about it with a third party of someone who actually has interest in it, it can be cathartic and healing just to be able to talk about it.
Yeah, I'd agree with everybody else. Just hopefully the renewed attention on these cases can bring some answers for the families.
Yeah, I want families to know that, like, maybe the public has forgotten their loved one's stories, but, like, we haven't. There are people who are still interested in hearing it.
Yeah.
I totally agree with that. And hopefully we will achieve all of that, no matter the case. For those cases that do have hotlines, I will cover them right now. Now, for the Lee Van Leeuwenhoek case, if you want to contact them, the number is 570-517-3052. And for the Courtney Stauffer case, the hotline there is 717-272-2054. Both those numbers will be listed in the upcoming story that will be placed along with the podcast itself, which will be coming out. Well, it's already come up now. Now, if you happen to have any case on your mind that you think we should cover, well, email us at returntoview@gmail.com. That's returntoview@gmail.com. And we'll get back to you with the case that is near and dear to your heart. Many thanks to the Daily American, the Bucks County Courier Times, the Beaver County Times, the Pocono Record, and Lebanon Daily News for their partnership and research in helping us properly take the storytelling journey into true crime. Easy for me to say. And that will do it for this special presentation. I hope you enjoyed this different look at true crime, the cases covered from a reporter's or journalist's perspective. I'm Cole Jance Johnson, and on behalf of Joe, Danny, Hannah, Matthew, Eric, and Bruce, I thank you for returning to view the cases we have covered thus far and the ones upcoming. See you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you for choosing Return to View, the Roundtable. To reach Cole Johnson on Twitter, go to @hostColeJohnson. To reach the show, email returntoview@gmail.com. All episodes are available for download on select USA Today Network e-edition platforms and newspapers. It is for subscribers only. Join now for just $1 to receive premium content like Return to View. That's $1 to become a subscriber and a Return to View loyal listener. This has been a Comey Media Incorporated presentation in association with the USA Today Network.